Thank you. Be seated. In the consolidated arguments of Owens Corning versus Carter, Carroll, Judge Chandler, and the court, Justice Hankinson is not sitting, and the court is ready to hear oral argument from the appellant.
May it please the court, Mr. John Corning will present arguments for the appellant. Appellants have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, questions presented to the court's decision are, first of all, can Texas limit the right of foreign litigants with no connection to this state and whose cause of action arose elsewhere to sue in Texas courts? The answer to this question we submit is unequivocally yes. Stated differently, are Texas taxpayers compelled by the Texas and federal constitutions to subsidize litigation by persons having no connection with this state and whose claim arose out of state? We would just as unequivocally say the answer to that is no. We ask the court to decide there is no constitutional right to forum shop. Regarding the privileges and immunities challenge, this case boils down to what kinds of distinctions can be made between Texas residents on one hand and residents of other states whose cause of action arose there. This court will not be writing on a clean slate. 44 states have borrowing statutes like that challenged here. None has ever been invalidated on privileges and immunities grounds.
Mr. Corner, let me ask you a question now. So I'm clear on the position. Under the 71.031 provision, it says that a cause of if the only connection to Texas is that the injured person is a Texas citizen, they can sue here. But the next provision says if they don't have that connection, then they can't sue here. And your position is that Texas can give a Texas citizen rights that it does not give to other citizens of the country.
That's true, Your Honor, and there's at least two United States Supreme Court decisions which have so held. The Douglas case and the Mayfield case have unequivocally held that Texas may prefer its own residents to those who have no connection to the state and whose claims arose out of state. The factual scenario giving rise to this legislation that was passed in 1997 is important. It starts with this court's decision in Alfaro, in which the court held that Section 71.031 of the Texas Civil Remedies and Practices Act abolished the common law doctrine of forum non-convenience in Texas. The court held in that decision that out-of-state litigants whose causes of action arose out of state had a right to file their claims in Texas courts. In 1993, the Texas legislature overruled the Alfaro decision, but exempted asbestos cases, the kinds of cases that are at issue here. Then in 1997, the legislature decided that it needed to patch or to fix the asbestos exemption to the Alfaro statute and enacted the three statutes in dispute here, the borrowing statute, Section 71.031A3, and the other two statutes challenged here, 71.052C, and B. The factual record the legislature was looking at is important because in 1993 there were less than 10,000 asbestos claims in Texas state courts and only a fraction of those arose out of state. By 1997 that figure had mushroomed to 47,000 claims with more than 40,000 of them arising out of state. The legislature was convinced on good evidence that the combination of a favorable statute of limitations and no forum non-convenience law, as it applies to asbestos cases, was a magnet that was drawing a disproportionate number of these cases to Texas. In other words, the legislature identified a problem. Thousands of out-of-state lawsuits with no connection to this state were flooding Texas courts and imposing an unreasonable burden on local and state taxpayers and on limited judicial resources. And the legislature addressed that problem by passage of these statutes in a fair and a reasonable way.
Let's separate out the legislature's decision to do that from future cases and focus on the effect that the legislature's action purported to have on pending matters.
Judge Dietz held, Your Honor, that the borrowing statute was unconstitutional as applied to cases that had accrued but had not yet been filed, and held that, but upheld these statutes on all other grounds other than privileges and immunities grounds. And of course, the appellees brought those claims that they lost on in the trial court here for the court's decision. But the trial court had before it, and you have before it here, whether these statutes operate retroactively in violation of Article 1, Section 16 of the Texas Constitution, and also whether it violates the open courts provision of the Texas Constitution. I guess the simplest answer to whether these are unconstitutionally retroactive is that they don't bar vested claims. Under this court's recent decision in the Quick case, which is a reiteration, of course, of a long line of
authority. But before you say that, when you say vested claim, you mean a claim that's been filed as a lawsuit?
I should have said vested rights, which means a final judgment. An accrued claim is not a vested right protected under the retroactivity provision of the Texas Constitution, under this court's decision in Quick versus City of Austin and a long line of cases. The important distinction as well is that the borrowing statute does not extinguish a cause of action, nor do any of these other two statutes. These are purely procedural statutes that are choice of law rules, the borrowing statute is, saying that in order to prevent the flood of cases from coming from Alabama to the state of Texas, that the statute of limitations in Alabama should be applied to those claims. This kind of borrowing statute has long been held constitutional by the United States Supreme Court back in 1920 in the Canadian Northern Railway Company case versus Egan. The court held that a borrowing statute like this passed constitutional muster under the Privileges and Immunities Clause. The court held that the constitutional requirement of that clause is met if the non-resident is given access to the courts on the terms that are themselves fair and reasonable, even though they may not be technically the same as those accorded to a resident.
Must you provide a reasonable time for suits to be commenced?
I presume, Your Honor, that you're referring to their argument of appellees at the Highland Park case, and the analysis there requires some period of time for them to bring their lawsuit. I would say the answer to that is no. Their right to file the lawsuit here in Texas is purely a creature of statute, Section 71.031. It's a matter of legislative grace that can be withheld or withdrawn at any time. They have no reasonable expectation of bringing a suit in Texas courts based on a claim that arose in Alabama. And Texas, in fact, could hold under the Chambers case that we cite that, in fact, Texas courts could decline to hear these kinds of cases at all and to merely hear asbestos cases arising in the state of Texas. And so the Texas legislature has indeed been more generous than required by the controlling authorities of the United States Supreme Court.
The question, though, is can we decide not to hear non-residents' other jurisdictional claims arising under other jurisdictions, but hear Texans' claims arising under the law of other jurisdictions? Can we make that discrimination?
The Supreme Court has clearly held that you can that the court can exclude out-of-state claims by non-Texas residents arising in other states and prefer to hear only Texas cases brought by Texas residents. This statute, these statutes apply only if at the time the cause of action arose that the plaintiff was not a Texas resident and the cause of action accrued in that other state. And so the Texas legislature can decide that if it is a Texas resident, that it may prefer its own citizens to the use of the court facilities and the civil justice system that the Texas resident, in fact, subsidizes through payment of their tax dollars, and to exclude non-residents entirely. Given the fact that the
I'm sorry. Along that line, the breadth of the Supreme Court's view on this extend to, say, a business enterprise which meets the long-arm jurisdiction statute, where you could sue them and you could bring them into a state court? Does it go to the breadth of saying that we will allow Texas citizens to go to the far reaches of the jurisdictional, personal jurisdiction issue and bring a foreign defendant into Texas courts to defend, but we won't permit a foreign plaintiff to use the far reaches of the jurisdiction to bring in a foreign defendant to try this? In other words, looking at the defendant's point of view, can Texas prefer bringing Texas lawsuits and bring that defendant down here, but not let that defendant come down here when a plaintiff is not at state?
Your Honor, the forum nonconvenience statute applies assuming there is already jurisdiction against the defendant. And so I guess if I understand your question correctly, the answer is yes. Legislature can prefer a Texas resident who files suit against an out-of-state corporation who has over which jurisdiction may be acquired in the state of Texas and deny access or deny access on conditions to an out-of-state resident altogether. As I said, the legislature, given the fact that they could under the Chamber's decision and decline to allow cognizance of these claims in Texas courts at all, surely then it must be able to do something short of that and allow access to Texas courts based on certain conditions. And the legislature, of course, was confronted with an emergency. This statute, the barring statute, Senate Bill 220, was passed as an emergency bill that became immediately effective upon passage as opposed to the traditional 90-day waiting period, September 1st, because of the flood of cases that were coming into the Texas courts. The two statutes, the two other statutes, the one that compels the capping of punitive damages or else a dismissal in the event that there is no voluntary agreement to cap punitive damages, and the mandatory dismissal statute, are a rational response to what the legislature saw as between the time the legislature convened in January 1997 and April the 4th, 1997, there were additional 4,900 claims filed in an effort to beat the statute. On one day alone, the day before this statute became effective, on the 29th of May, on May the 28th, 1997, there were 2,800 claims filed by a single law firm in an effort to beat the statute. And so we say that the legislature may constitutionally, without running into the open courts doctrine or the retroactivity prohibition of the Texas Constitution, and without violating the Privileges and Immunities Clause of the United States Constitution, address a real problem, and that is an attempt to subvert the legislature's effort to protect the limited judicial resources that we have available in our state courts. I might just say a word about the fact-finding that the Judge Deeds purported to make. Of course, that we have at present time district judges in Texas and Cass County who held these statutes to be constitutional. I've just been advised that in Lamar County there has been a contrary decision holding these statutes unconstitutional, as Judge Deeds did, and perhaps even on additional grounds, some of which are discussed here. But of course, as this court knows, it's inappropriate for an individual district court to make fact findings at odds with what the legislature has determined the reasons for its actions to be the basis for its action that would be contrary to the legislature's reasons for passing the statute in the first place. If there are no other questions at this time, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
One thing you have not talked about is subsection B, the statute that requires dismissal or motion of the defendant if he files within a certain time frame. Could you address why that's not an ex post facto law or taking away vested rights?
Well, it's not a vested right because under this court's authorities, only once an accrued claim has been reduced to final judgment is it a vested right that's protected under the retroactivity provision of the Texas Constitution. This is a mandatory dismissal. It's a little different from foreign nonconvenience, which is a discretionary decision by a trial court. But there is no case that has been held that would prohibit, where it's been held that the court would be prohibited, or the legislature would be prohibited from passing such a statute. And indeed, as I say, if the legislature could withhold jurisdiction altogether of these foreign claims, then surely they may allow jurisdiction on, they may allow these claims to proceed on some conditions, and this is one of the conditions in addition to Section C, which requires a punitive damage cap election.
No, but B, there's no condition under which they can proceed.
Right. It's basically designed to address the attempt to subvert the legislature's attempt to pass a statute.
Doesn't that run afoul of our Texas Constitution, though, by being retroactively effective?
No, Your Honor, because the only claims against which that is directed are accrued claims. That is, somebody who claims to have an asbestos lawsuit. But since it's not a vested right, because it has not yet been rendered reduced to judgment under Quick versus City of Austin and an unbroken chain of authorities by this court, then it does not run into the retroactivity prohibition of the Texas Constitution.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from applicants.
May I please the court? Mr. Steve
Bachman,
and will present argument for the appellee.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may I please the court? Justice Cornett has presented the court with an articulate constitutional defense of the traditional common law doctrine of forum nonconvenience and of borrowing statutes in general. But what I'd like to do is focus the court's attention on the actual statutory provision of 71.052 that's at issue here, which bears very little resemblance to the common law doctrine of forum nonconvenience that was at issue in other cases which Justice Cornett cited. And focus the court's attention as well on the particular manner in which the borrowing statute that the Texas legislature has passed has been applied, which is to cut off the rights of Alabama asbestos victims before they've had any opportunity to discover their injury. I'm going to start with 71.052B and move on later to the borrowing statute. Now, first of all, as I've just alluded to, 71.052 is not a forum nonconvenience provision. It is a mandatory, not a discretionary provision, as the traditional common law doctrine is. It requires no balancing whatsoever of any public or private interest, as the common law doctrine does. And as well as 71.051, the prospective forum nonconvenience provision that the legislature enacted at the same time. And it has no requirement, as the common law did and as 71.051 does, that there be an alternative forum where the plaintiff can get an adequate remedy for their claim. Now,
on that score, when you talk about causes of action that have expired before they've had a chance to know about, are you talking about Alabama statute of limitations issues or Texas statute of limitations issues?
We're talking here about the Texas borrowing statute applying Alabama statute of limitations.
So your argument really is that the Alabama statute of limitations is what's affected their rights, because otherwise
you're arguing that in Texas the statute of limitations would not have run and they'd still have a cause of action.
That's correct, Your Honor. If, as would have happened at common law with respect to people coming from Alabama asserting an Alabama cause of action in a Texas court, if the Texas statute of limitations applies to the claim as it would have been in common law, their claim is not barred. It's barred by the borrowing statute taking the Alabama limitations rule, which does not include a discovery exception.
Enlighten me a little bit, but if Texas, I guess the statute of limitations would apply if they came to Texas, even if the cause of action didn't arise in Texas.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Because we'd say that's a remedial statute, not a substantive choice of law question.
Texas, like virtually every other jurisdiction at common law, applies the law of the forum with respect to limitations rules. And so at common law, had this claim been brought by Mr. Horton or Mr. Moore or the other clients that I represent in a Texas court, Texas limitations law would apply.
And so what happens in, at least when you're talking about 71.052, the argument here is that they had a cause of action that had accrued, that the legislature came in and then shortened the statute of limitations on without giving a reasonable period of time to file their lawsuit.
That's the argument with respect to Article 1, Section 16 of the Texas Constitution, Your Honor. And that is our argument. But with respect to the Privileges and Immunities Clause of the Federal Constitution, I think Justice Heck, in his question to Justice Corn, pointed out where that argument comes from. And that is that the Texas law, 71.052, does not permit a trial court to dismiss a claim by a Texas resident that arises in another jurisdiction. Even if there's nothing that claim has to do with Texas other than the fact that the plaintiff lives in Texas, Texas courts are not permitted to dismiss that claim under 71.052 or 71.051 for that matter. And for that reason, because there is that discrimination on the basis of state residence or state citizenship, the Privileges and Immunities Clause of Article 4, Section 2 of the United States Constitution is called, it applies. And at that point, the burden shifts to the defendants or to the government to justify that discrimination.
What troubles me about that argument most is that you could take it into account in forum non-convenience decisions, could you not?
Yes, Your Honor, you can take...
And that wouldn't violate the Privileges and Immunities.
It is one factor to take into account under a traditional form non-convenience, but it is not a determinative factor.
But let me be sure about this. If a court decided not to dismiss on form non-convenience a case by a Texas resident on a claim that arose outside the state, but did reach the opposite conclusion in a case by a non-Texas resident, that would not violate the privileges.
I think, Your Honor, if the trial court had made a fact finding that these two cases are exactly alike, except for the fact that the cause of action of one involved a Texas resident and the other not, I think that would be an abuse of discretion because it would, in fact, violate the Privileges and Immunities Clause. Residence is one factor to take into account under the balancing test in form non-convenience, but it is not the outcome determinative factor, and when it becomes the outcome determinative factor, that becomes exactly the kind of discrimination that the Privileges and Immunities Clause was intended to prohibit. And that doesn't end the inquiry. At that point, the burden shifts, as I said, to the government, and they have to show a substantial reason for the discrimination against citizens of other states, and then they have to show as well that there is a substantial relationship between that reason and the actual discriminatory effect. And on this record, Judge Deitz made a fact finding that no substantial reason exists. And I submit, contrary to what Justice Cornyn said, that it is not the role of trial courts to second guess the legislature, that standard, which this court has articulated several times, is only applicable in the rational basis context. When you have a heightened level of constitutional scrutiny, here you've got an intermediate level of scrutiny that applies under, as a matter of federal constitutional law, under the Privileges and Immunities Clause, the same standard that would apply under federal law in a gender discrimination case or in a case involving restrictions on commercial speech. When you've got an intermediate level of constitutional scrutiny, it makes no sense and it is absolutely not appropriate for the trial court to defer to the legislature's finding. The trial court has a duty to look and see if the government, or in this case the defendants, the proponents of the statute, have met their constitutional burden of coming forward with evidence that there is a substantial basis for the discrimination.
Regardless of whether it's the substantial basis test or the rational relation test, isn't the concept of what the trial court is doing the same, and that is reevaluating what the policy decision was of the legislature? And how can the trial court, in listening to evidence, reevaluate whether or not what the legislature did was based upon some substantial state interest?
Well, I think that that's what courts do in applying the law to the facts in any event, Your Honor, but I think that once
when courts are applying the law to the facts, typically it is not a situation where they are evaluating policy decisions made by the legislature. So let's focus solely upon reevaluating policy decisions made by the legislature.
I think, Your Honor, that under an intermediate level of constitutional scrutiny, that the role of determining whether or not a basis or an interest, a governmental interest that has been articulated by the legislature for justifying some discrimination, that role no longer is one where the court is to defer to the legislature. The role becomes one where it is the duty of the court to determine whether the interest articulated is in fact substantial in a constitutional sense.
Supreme Court decision supports that?
Supreme Court decisions, there's a long line of decisions in the gender discrimination context, and as I say, the intermediate level of scrutiny that applies under privileges and immunity is identical. Substantial relationship, substantial interest, and there must be a substantial relationship between the discrimination and the interest articulated. And Craig versus Foreign, Reed versus Reed, and most recently the 11th Circuit.
What I'm talking about specifically is Supreme Court decisions that say that the trial court does not defer to the legislative policy analysis and that appellate courts cannot undertake a de novo review.
The gender discrimination line of cases, Your Honor, there's a long line of cases that address that and say that it is the role of the trial court to make sure that the government has met it, or the proponent of the statute has met its burden of showing the substantial basis. And the most recent articulation of that that goes into that in some detail is by the 11th Circuit in a case called Engineering Contractors Association of South Florida versus Metropolitan Dade County. It's a 1997 decision, cert denied by the 11th Circuit, in which they reviewed under a clearly erroneous standard the trial court's finding that there wasn't a substantial basis proven by the government to justify an affirmative action program that had gender discrimination within it.
Don't we at least have to defer to their judgment, calls about what the facts are? In other words, maybe the burden on the state courts is not enough to justify this under the privilege and immunities clause, but whether there is a burden or not, isn't that a legislative call?
I think not, Your Honor. It clearly would be if we were looking at this under a rational basis level of constitutional scrutiny, but I think as a matter of federal constitutional law, and you need to look at Engineering Contractors Association of South Florida, it is in fact the responsibility of the trial court to make that factual determination. And then once that factual determination has been made by the trial court, it gets reviewed under the same standards that factual determinations always get reviewed. In this context, we're sort of in an odd direct appeal context. I assume that it would be against the great weight of preponderance of the evidence.
I'm not sure. I guess I have the same question. It seems to me what it is there facts in the record for the trial court to make the conclusion that the statute is appropriately supported by the legislative facts. It seems to me it is not binding on this court what the trial court found as the legislative facts. It seems to me your argument really is that the proponents of the statute in the face of your challenge did not produce evidence supporting the factual basis for the statute. And you're not really here arguing that Judge Dietz's conclusions to the opposite, the facts are the opposite of what they said, is really not what you're supporting. You're simply saying that there is not factual basis upon which the trial court could have found this statute constitutional in the face of your challenge.
Well,
and we're free to look at those same legislative facts and conclude one way or the other, either facts support it or don't, and your argument is that the proponents had the burden. So if there's a question of meeting that burden, then they must lose.
Well, I think that they have a burden, and they have a burden both as a factual burden, that it's as a initial matter up to the trial court to determine, and they have a legal burden. And I think that they get mixed together here. But as to whether or not, for example, there is any court backlog or docket backlog or access to the courts by Texas residents that is being created by the filing of out-of-state asbestos lawsuits, that's a matter of fact that I believe that it was up to Judge Dietz to decide. He made a finding with regard to that, and I think this court cannot overturn that finding without concluding that it's against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence. Now, but no matter what, how the court comes out on that debate, this statute still doesn't satisfy the constitutional burden because there are far less restrictive alternatives that the legislature could have enacted if they chose not to.
Before you go to that, would it violate the Privileges and Immunities Clause for Alabama to pass 71052?
If they created a situation, Your Honor, where there was mandatory dismissal of claims from by out-of-staters, yes, I believe that would, in fact, and there was an exclusion for Alabama residents who had a claim that arose out-of-state, then yes, that would violate the Privileges and Immunities Clause.
Why, if it turned out that every other state in the country had a longer statute of limitations and applied the discovery, why would it violate?
Well, I think, if I understand your question, I think we're skipping to the borrowing statute issue.
No, I'm still concerned about the adequate remedy.
Oh, okay. Well, that would be one provision, Your Honor, that Alabama would, I guess, you know, it wouldn't be a totally analogous situation, and the alternative forum part of it wouldn't be as onerous.
Wouldn't be onerous at all.
Yeah. But on the other hand, it would still be a mandatory provision that wouldn't require any balancing, and there would still be less restrictive alternatives that the Alabama legislature could enact that they chose not to, that would in fact mean that there wasn't a substantial relationship with a substantial state interest. So it would be less burdensome statute in the sense that probably there are alternative forums available for people other than Alabama, but at least in the context of toxic exposure cases, there certainly are. But it would still be a more onerous statute than is required to advance the state interest, which is keeping cases out if they don't have connection with Alabama.
What troubles me here is that the fact that, or the argument that Alabama is out of line sort of drives the constitutional analysis about what Texas can do. We're not here concerned about whether New York or Montana is out of line. And I don't see how that can be under the Privileges and Immunities Clause.
Well, Your Honor, the Privileges and Immunities Clause doesn't have a devil-made-me-do-it exception. In other words, the fact that Alabama and the Alabama Supreme Court's decision is the source of why Alabama residents don't have an adequate remedy doesn't change the fact that the analysis under the Privileges and Immunities Clause looks at what Texas provides to its own residents, compares that with what it provides to, in terms of access to the courts for citizens of other states. If there's a discrimination there, which there is under 71.052, 71.051, and the borrowing provision of 71.031, that doesn't apply to Texas residents, even if their claim doesn't have anything to do with Texas. And because there is that exclusion, because there is that discrimination, you have to look and see whether or not the burden has been satisfied, and here it simply is not. Now, turning to the borrowing provision, Justice Cornyn...
You weren't going, discuss less onerous alternatives?
Well, yes, Your Honor, and thank you for bringing me back to that. There are at least three, and we pointed them out in our brief. First of all, they could have applied 71.051 or the common law doctrine of forum nonconvenience retroactively, so that the cases that are now subject to mandatory dismissal could have had applied to them the common law doctrine or 71.051, which is the statement by the legislature of what the prospective policy of this state is going to be with respect to keeping cases in Texas. If you can satisfy today, as a litigant who files their lawsuit today, a trial court judge that you have met 71.051, then your case, according to the legislature, has sufficient connection with the state to remain here. And yet there are many people who are mandatorily dismissed under 71.052 who, in fact, would satisfy 71.051. And I submit virtually all Alabama asbestos plaintiffs fall in that category. And secondly, even if you could just impose a higher filing fee on out-of-state residents who file their claims in Texas, would eliminate or offset any increased cost that it imposes on the Texas court system. And, or third, you can do what many trial courts around the state are already doing and have common issues dockets devoted to asbestos cases, which will streamline the process and allow them to go forward smoothly as the legislative record and the factual record in this in the trial court reflects.
What about this notion, and that is that if these cases are brought here, and I forget the number, there are how many thousand?
40,000 or something like that.
40,000. Let's say that they are grouped together, 25 cases at a time, in the various trial courts that handle these. And not every trial court in the state handles these cases. There's only, several dozen, let's say 100 trial courts to handle these cases. And if we have 40,000, that means that each case, each court is going to have, 400 of these cases? And if they're grouped together at 25 at a time, that's going to take a lot of years just to handle those cases. With that being the situation, why would that not be depriving Texas citizens of their right to access to the courts and getting their asbestos claims heard and their non-asbestos claims heard?
Because the common issues can be heard commonly by one judge that sits once a month determining whatever issues have come, pretrial issues have come up, and they are often common to all of the cases. And that process has been in place in Dallas County, it's been in place in Harris County, and the testimony of the asbestos common issue judges in those two jurisdictions was that there was no deprivation of access to the courts for Texas residents or for any other type of claim, any other non-asbestos type of claim, because of the streamlining process.
Let me ask you, Bill, again, just to follow up on something I asked about earlier. Say Alabama had a very short statute of limitations just across the board, say 3-month statute of limitations for all claims that could be brought in the state of Alabama, and the Supreme Court of that state upheld that. Couldn't the surrounding states do virtually anything to keep Alabama citizens from crossing the line and trying to get what obviously they would want but can't get in their own state? Access to the courthouse to urge these claims?
Well, Your Honor, the answer is if what they do to keep them out is apply the traditional common law doctrine, apply a balancing test that is equally applicable to residents of their state, apply a borrowing provision that is equally applicable to residents of their state, then I think the answer is they could constitutionally do that.
So it looks like the Constitution requires you to treat your own states, your own citizens poorly because Alabama has chosen to treat its citizens.
The Constitution requires as a matter of analysis to look at how you're treating your own citizens vis-a-vis how you're treating citizens of other states. That's how the analysis works. And for better or worse, that's what the United States Supreme Court has said. And they also said
Are there any privileges and immunities in cases and from any other context that involves, many of them in the welfare situation, for instance, involve cases where the state back home is providing abnormally low benefit at the
issue is, what does another state have to do?
I am not aware of that, Your Honor, except to the extent of, obviously, the borrowing statute case, Canadian Railway versus Egan, that Justice Cornyn cited, is an analogous situation and obviously directly on point with respect to the borrowing provision. And in Canadian Northern Railway versus Egan, what Justice Cornyn ignores about that decision is that not once, not twice, but three separate times in the opinion, the court emphasizes that the discrimination by excluding state residents from the application of the borrowing statute is only permissible to the extent that the borrowing statute allows a reasonable time for the foreign plaintiff to access the courts, a reasonable time that it would allow an ordinarily diligent person to access the courts, which of course, with respect as applied to Alabama asbestos plaintiffs, this borrowing provision does not, and it failed the privileges and immunities test under Canadian Northern Railway versus Egan for that reason. Any other questions?
But you do think that the privileges and immunities jurisprudence is different today than it was in the early part of the century?
It is different today, Your Honor, than it was in the early part of the century, and our brief discusses that. The one thing that they say in the reply brief about that point is that Missouri versus Mayfield was decided 2 years after the Toomer versus Whitfield case, which is sort of the landmark modern privileges and immunities case. But the thing about Missouri versus Mayfield is that it did not involve an attack on a form non-convenience statute on the basis of the privileges and immunities clause. There is a sentence in the case that is totally dicta about how privileges and immunities is not violated by traditional form non-convenience doctrine. But the parties did not argue and the court did not purport to decide whether or not privileges and immunities would actually be applicable. What was at issue there was Georgia had determined as a matter of preemption that it could not apply form of nonconvenience to FELA cases because the U.S. Supreme Court had said that when you're in federal court, a federal court cannot dismiss a FELA case on the basis of form of nonconvenience. The Supreme Court said to Georgia, the U.S. Supreme Court said to the Georgia Supreme Court, you did not have to do that. You could have determined as a matter of your state law, despite what we said, you were not preempted. And that's all that says, and that's been reinforced since then, but it does not, the court was not there saying that under a modern privileges and immunities analysis, this passes muster. And of course, it would be a very different animal, and was a very different animal with 71.052 in any event.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
What the appellees are urging this court to hold is that while the Alabama statute of limitations may be constitutionally applied in Alabama, it may not be constitutionally applied in Texas. And of course, if they're right, then they have greater rights in Texas than they have in their home state, which is a bizarre situation indeed. The Privileges and Immunities Clause has never been interpreted to require that Alabama residents be given greater rights in Texas than they enjoy in their own state. Mr. Baughman argues that this statute is different because it requires a mandatory dismissal. The statute section 71.052B. But as the Supreme Court of the United States held in Chambers, as against a privileges and immunities challenge, a state may choose not to allow any out-of-state residents to sue in its courts. In that case, it was involved the wrongful death statute, which recognized only claims brought on behalf of decedents who were from Ohio. And no one from any other state could file a lawsuit and recover for wrongful death in an Ohio court. And the United States Supreme Court expressly held that that was permissible as against a privileges and immunities challenge. Also under Mayfield, the Mayfield case decided in 1950, an FELA case. The Justice Frankfurter wrote an opinion that said that the state may prefer its own residents as against non-residents and choose not to even entertain FELA cases brought in its state courts. Those, if not exactly the same, are equivalent to the mandatory dismissal provision of 71.052B. It's not common law form nonconvenience, but the United States Supreme Court has held that even if it's not, if it's in essence a refusal to hear the claim outright, that that still passes privileges and immunities muster.
But I understand the appellant part that the privileges and immunities clause does not, the appellants themselves argue, that the privileges and immunities clause does not permit discrimination at the time of filing, only at the time the claim arose. But doesn't this statute discriminate at the time of filing? Because it allows Texans to bring claims that arose outside the state, but not non-Texans.
Our answer to that, Your Honor, is that obviously whether residency at the time the claim arose and the time of filing are obviously different times, but the legislature, in essence, is entitled to hold to address the evil of form shopping by those folks who are residents of other states when their claim arose out of state. And we don't think that that distinction between the time that the claim arose and the time the claim was actually filed is unconstitutional discriminatory. The standard of review that Mr. Baughman argues for has never been held to apply in a privileges and immunities context. They've been unable to cite a single case, and indeed we've been unable
You're talking about the engineering contractor's case?
Talking about the intermediate level of review that he says applies in a gender discrimination case under an equal protection analysis. He says, and this it's the same test that's been applied in a privileges and immunities context, but indeed the intermediate scrutiny level of review is an equal protection standard review and has never been held by the United States Supreme Court in either the Mayfield case, which expressly held that there was no violation of privileges and immunities clause in that case. They didn't purport to apply an intermediate scrutiny standard review. And when Mayfield was reaffirmed in American Dredging in 1994, there was no statement by the court, no implication that a different standard review, one that would be applied in an equal protection analysis in a gender discrimination case, would be applied in the privileges and immunities context. Fundamentally, what the appellees are arguing is that this court should not defer to the legislative policy judgment that these out-of-state cases are placing an undue burden on Texas taxpayers and on limited judicial resources in this case. They say, well, they could have passed a different statute, which might have accomplished some of what they intended, but this court's role is not to rewrite the statute. We ask the court to affirm the Constitution of the statute, reads three statutes in all respects.
Quick question. If the court were to rule in your favor, what happens to these plaintiffs' claims?
Well, presumably the claims that have been that were subject to 71.052B would have to be dismissed. And we submit they could not be refiled because to allow that would subvert the legislative intention. It doesn't make much sense to say they have to be dismissed, but then you can come back and refile them later on.
Is there some other forum where they would likely be refiled?
Ohio. They've got a discovery rule and no borrowing statute, and they could file suit there, and I believe there are a handful of other states with no borrowing statute.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the third argument. The court will now take a recess until 1:45 this afternoon.
All rise.